You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. I hope you caught our documentary on Friday titled What's for Lunch? The Move to Improve School Nutrition. It explored the new trends in bringing healthy foods to school meals and then getting kids to eat them. A number of projects and programs in our region are models for the country in terms of their food and education, including some in Davis, Elk Grove, and San Juan Unified Districts. And by the way, you can still hear the program at capradio.org/lunch. Today, though, let's jump off onto a branch of the discussion, and that is specifically what to do about the food that gets tossed into the trash during school mealtimes. So joining us by phone from Berkeley is Zenobia Barlow, Executive Director and co-founder of the Center for Eco-Literacy in Berkeley. Hello, Zenobia.
Hi there.
And Mary Johnson Pat, a freelance writer for the National Education Journal District Administration. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
So welcome to Insight, both of you. And Zenobia, let's start by talking about the scope of waste in school lunches. Can you give us some perspective?
Well, I think so. For about 15 years, we've been working on something called Rethinking School Lunch. And we have a guide on our website. And waste management is one of the issues, one of 10 lenses of looking at school lunch. So you're right, there's a real problem. About $600 million is estimated to be lost every year in food waste in the National School Lunch Program, about almost 20,000 pounds per elementary school. So it's a big deal. We worked with a large urban school district a couple of years ago and determined that probably 70% of the waste stream in an urban district is food-related. So this is a part of the school lunch that we really need to take a look at.
A recent report in NPR talked about just American life in general and that we throw away about 40% of our food. So what percentage would you say of school lunch food gets tossed?
I don't think I know what percentage. So much of it depends on packaging, how much of it's processed, the quality of food, and also whether children are being hurried through the lunch line and they're, you know, dying to get into recess. And so, you know, it's a complex equation.
Our documentary focused on the taste and the nutritional content of food, but waste issue was also brought up, and it has to do with timing in some respects. So here's a portion of our school lunch special that referenced a schedule change at an Elk Grove elementary school, and in this case, it's made a difference.
Silent lunch has begun. Anything students don't finish goes in the trash. Whole pears, untouched sandwiches, still sealed packages of kid carrots, entire cartons of milk. To inspire a clean plate club mentality, Principal Jennifer Avey initiated silent lunch.
And it's actually almost 5 minutes of quiet time at the end of their 20-minute lunchtime. So it allows them to focus on finishing their food and having enough time to actually eat that day.
That was Elaine Korn reporting from David Reese Elementary School in Elk Grove. And Mary Johnson Pat, I'd like you to jump in here because you wrote about timing being a critical issue in school lunch. So would you explain the recess before lunch movement?
I'll try to do it briefly. Yes, I contribute to a national education journal that goes to superintendents across the country and who are always trying to exchange innovative ideas. And I read a brief article in the New York Times at the beginning of last year about the idea of recess before lunch, which involved switching the timing of lunch, obviously, because so many kids are anxious to get outside after being constrained. And so they rush through lunch, they throw the food away, they get out on the playground, they have very often behavior issues, they come back in and then they go to class and they can't settle down. So if you just switch all of that, if they get to play first and come in, they eat better and they socialize and they go back to school in a more calm fashion. And so this is only happening according to the most recent examination of this in about 5% of schools around the country. And I wondered why, if it's common sense. And part of the problem also is that recess has been cut, morning recess. So there, by the time lunch comes, kids are choosing between food and the natural desire to play. So I profiled several school districts that are trying this, and in every case, every administrator, every teacher, every nutrition person said there are multiple benefits. Food waste goes down, nutrition goes up, behavior issues go away, and so I also examined why schools are reluctant to do that, and you might want to hear those points. But does that play into your discussion today?
It does. And Zenobia, I want you to jump in there because you had a pilot program in Berkeley. How did it go, and what did you learn?
Well, we've worked in a school lunch initiative in Berkeley for 10 years, and then we've worked in lots of other school districts. Every time I've ever been involved in a switching of lunch and recess, it's had a profoundly positive effect. But, you know, school districts are being pressured by all kinds of people to do all kinds of things. It's a change of the bell schedule. And part of it is curriculum minutes are making lunch shorter and shorter. But I think the reversal of lunch and recess is a profoundly effective strategy.
And it's interesting that we are talking about an issue of waste, but what it really comes down to is the food actually getting into the children. And you're saying it's far more successful if recess happens before lunch.
Every time I've ever, as the children calm down and are allowed and encouraged to eat in a much more civilized and socialized manner, there are all these attributes that occur, just as your other interviewer just was describing.
That is the voice of Zenobia Barlow. She's the executive director and co-founder of the Center for Eco-Literacy. And Mary Johnson Pat, we're also talking with a freelance writer for the journal District Administration. So, Mary, this started in Montana, which is kind of interesting, but would you list one or two of the reasons that schools haven't adopted it so easily and quickly?
Aside from the way it's always been done that way, I wanted to look at each of these objections, one of them being sanitation. They'd be coming off the school grounds and going to lunch, and they'd have to wash their hands. And so some districts have just put in stations where they can use hand sanitizers. And some have said, well, it only works in small districts because it's just too complicated to try to manage the flow of children this way. But I went to Clark County, Nevada, which has 310,000 kids in their school district in the Las Vegas area, and they're adopting this. They have adopted it. And there they have a very high percentage of kids on free and reduced lunch, and they come to school hungry sometimes, so they have their breakfast program, but they were still throwing lunch away because they needed to get out to play. So this way they're getting better nutrition. And I think the main things are just opening your mind to reversing things, and also getting buy-in from the parents and the local district administrators, the principals. It can't be mandated from top down, they said. It's got to come from bottom up. So I've just thrown a bunch of things out there, but I'd be curious to hear what Zenobia says.
And we are talking a lot about timing. Yeah. I don't want to diminish the fact that sometimes it is plain old presentation and preparation of the food that can make a difference. And again, we go back to the documentary we did Friday, and let's listen to this little clip about oranges.
We find that if a child has to peel an orange, they won't necessarily eat it. But when it's already cut for them, they enjoy eating it like a smile. They put it over their teeth and eat the actual flesh of the product.
And that might give people a smile, but Zenobia, in terms of timing, presentation, all those issues, are schools doing enough? Is there a lot more room for improvement here to avoid the waste and feed the kids?
Well, I was in a school in Oakland at lunch the other day, and it was mostly Spanish-speaking kids, and someone had the wisdom to buy an orange slicer, and so they could put the orange through a slicer, and it would turn out like 8 slices of orange, and they had put it on a plate, and someone was, I'm going to say lovingly, going around from table to table and offering children slices of orange. It was beautiful to see. And the children were taking them and eating them. And I've seen, I can't tell you how many tons of oranges I've seen thrown away because little kids really can't cope with an orange. So some of it is just how these children are presented the food, the time they have, the packaging, because sometimes the packaging of this processed food is very unappealing. So, you know, if you were going to design a system in which you would create eating disorders, this is what we would do, is we would give kids very short amounts of time. We would present them unappealing food. We'd make them choose between activity and eating. I mean, it's, you know, school lunch is a very important place for all of us to change some practices. And, you know, I know that a large foundation in California, the California Endowment, has concluded that an intervention around school meals is the most strategic and most sustainable intervention for children's health that we can make.
Well, certainly with the way you laid it out, it sounds very urgent. I want to thank you both for contributing to our conversation today, Zenobia and Mary. Many thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you
so much.
It was a pleasure.
Zenobia Barlow, Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Center for Eco-Literacy, and Mary Pat, a freelance writer for the National Education Journal District Administration. The full Capital Public Radio documentary can be heard at capradio.org/lunch. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Still ahead, some encouraging economic indicators for California's Central Valley.